here was the story by the fake news. The president was 15 minutes late for the Queen.
Wrong.
And then here's the rest of the story. No, here's the rest. Here's the rest of the story. So they said I was late when I was actually on. Number one. Number two, I guess the meeting was scheduled for 15 minutes and it lasted for almost an hour. The president overstayed. So I was late and I overstayed. And honestly, folks, it was such a beautiful, beautiful visit and afternoon. But they can make anything bad because they are the fake, fake, disgusting news.
President Trump at a rally in Pennsylvania last night, again villainizing the media to, of course, the loud cheers from his supporters. Trump's been on the road all week, stumping for Republicans as the midterms get closer. But at a rally in Florida a few days ago, he had to share coverage with some of the attendees in the audience, specifically people wearing T-shirts and holding signs with the letter Q. The Q, we now know, stands for QAnon, a sweeping right-wing conspiracy theory that makes Pizzagate look tame. Jane Costin is senior politics reporter at Vox, where she focuses on conservatism and the American right. And she joins us now to talk about this conspiracy theory and how it fits in with a general suspicion of the news on the right, a suspicion the president regularly encourages. Hi there.
Hello. How are you doing?
Great. Well, what is the central conspiracy for QAnon believers?
Well, I think the most succinct way to put it is Donald Trump is in complete control of absolutely everything. The conspiracy theory dictates that Trump is actually secretly working with Robert Mueller to investigate basically every Democrat you've heard of and some you haven't, to eventually, or maybe already, arrest all of them for being maybe pedophiles.
Oh, okay. So that's where it kind of sounds like Pizzagate, because that was
right,
also involving a pedophile ring.
Yeah, the theme of kind of going after pedophiles has been a part of this for a long time.
Why is that the theme?
Well, I think that it's, you know, as we've seen recently with James Gunn's firing from the Guardians of the Galaxy franchise and just kind of recent instances where kind of alt-right figures try to get people fired by alleging that they're pedophiles, you know, saying that someone is a pedophile is probably the easiest and most effective way to tarnish someone's reputation without having to provide any proof or evidence. And that's something, you know, Slate had a great piece from Christina Carucci in July talking about this because, you know, pedophilia is rightfully and universally considered to be a horrific and horrendous crime. The people who are really deeply enmeshed in QAnon, they posit that, you know, they're trying to save children. That's why they're following this conspiracy theory. That's why they're tweeting about it constantly. You know, what could be wrong with trying to rescue children? And that's something, you know, Roseanne Barr tweeted about this, about how, you know, oh, so many children have been rescued. That's a QAnon reference.
Yes, Roseanne is a big fan of QAnon, maybe a member of it. I don't know. She retweets or she likes a lot of their posts.
Right. You know, it's interesting because as far as I know, she's probably the celebrity who's the most following QAnon directly. You've seen a lot of right-wing celebrities kind of wink and nod at it. You know, the actor James Woods and, you know, Sean Hannity kind of has referenced it a little bit, but not really. The former Major League Baseball pitcher Curt Schilling has as well, though now he doesn't want to talk about it. You know, there was a terrific piece in the Daily Beast today talking about how right-wing media does not really know how to handle this because it's a conspiracy theory that's too far out for even pretty far out right-wing media.
And this all began in late October after President Trump made a comment that I guess they saw as a signal that
right. He
had some kind of plan, some grand plan. I just want to play a little clip of what he said. This is in a back and forth with reporters.
What storm is
this? We have the world's great military people in this room. I will tell you that. And we're going to have a great evening. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
What storm, Mr. President?
You'll find out.
So there's a lot to this conspiracy theory that is kind of backfilling. And what I mean by that is, you know, the first post from an anonymous user claiming to be, you know, nicknamed Q, which is after a Q-level security clearance, which is a Department of Energy equivalent of top secret.
That's real, right?
That is an actual security clearance.
Just
but
making
actually,
sure.
You know, if you were a DOE employee with the security clearance, that doesn't mean that you'd be able to, like, get extremely high-level White House intelligence, just to be clear. And so they posted on November 1st that said that on November 3rd and 4th, John Podesta would be arrested and there'd be public riots organized and military control would be taken of the country and that, you know, the president would use the emergency broadcast system, which it should be noted doesn't really exist as it did before. You know, that would be broadcasting a direct message to all citizens. And obviously none of this happened.
Yeah.
And so you've seen that Q's postings have gotten incredibly vague as a response because, you know, if you're vague, it's easier than to say, like, oh, this will happen on a certain date. But what happened with that the storm reference is that people who followed Q started just kind of going through everything Trump had ever said looking for hints. And they took that as a hint after the fact. And so, you know, you see the reference to, quote unquote, the storm is this idea that one that someday on any on a specific date, basically like every Democrat will be arrested and essentially sent to Guantanamo Bay. And
all because they're involved in a child sex trafficking ring.
Yes, all because they're involved in a child sex trafficking ring. And random famous liberals, you know, they're recently on YouTube videos accusing, you know, Tom Hanks of being a pedophile who's soon to be on the way to prison. And so, you know, the storm will be the purge of all of these people.
All right. And so is it possible that Q, whoever he or she may be, and nobody knows who Q is, right?
No. And it's interesting because there are some QAnon people who think it's Trump himself. Others who believe that it is actually John F. Kennedy Jr., who faked his own death and is Q. But, you know, people who are not obviously as deeply invested in this conspiracy theory think that this is basically a 4chan troll / live action role play kind of thing, like a kind of made up story game in a sense online that just went too far. I think that it's useful to notice that a lot of the supporters or followers of QAnon are older people. They are people who are less kind of knowledgeable about trolling.
Yeah. So it could be one giant joke is basically what you're saying.
It could be one giant joke that has gone just really, really far. And at this point, it's become, you know, as all conspiracy theories do, something that can create a sense of order out of chaos.
So looking more broadly, do you see this as fitting into a general pattern of disbelief in the truth, the fungibility of facts that the administration is also encouraging in a certain way by constantly having these battles with the so-called fake media, fake news media? Is this all part of a piece?
I think in some ways, but I want to be really clear in saying that this is not just a specifically right-wing phenomenon. You know, I referenced in the piece I wrote about QAnon, you know, 9/11 truthers, and then I got a flood of emails from 9/11 truthers who were absolutely convinced, in a sense, that George W. Bush planned and orchestrated the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11th, 2001, you know, that the idea that the government, that you are, something is being hidden from you, and yet you can, you know, but there are ways to get around it, and you can have access to secret knowledge that makes terrible things make sense, is very tempting to a lot of people on both sides of the political spectrum.
Jane Costin is senior politics reporter at Vox. Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you.
While Trump supporters are reading the conspiracy theory tea leaves, the people who most want to get rid of President Trump, progressive Democrats, are meeting in New Orleans. Thousands of liberal activists and political candidates have arrived for the annual Netroots Conference. It runs through tomorrow. They're highlighting the deep strategy divide within the Democratic Party as it's trying to hone its message ahead of the midterms. David Siders is in New Orleans. He's reporting for Politico. Hi there.
Hi, good to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, so who are the highlights at Netroots this year?
Well, I think the big ones are Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris from California. We have Cory Booker. Tom Steyer has been a big presence.
Right, so some potential presidential candidates are there.
Yeah, well, you can go down the list and it gets bigger than some. You have the Jay Inslee is out, Bullock from Montana. I mean, there's a whole lot of people who are thinking about running for president who are here to, you know, to do some courting.
Right. And so what are they saying and how is it lining up with the liberal arm of the Democratic Party?
Well, the message from Tom Steyer is interesting, I think, to the group here, because it's all about impeachment and impeaching Trump. And of course, that's at odds with the Democratic Party leadership, which is, you know, would prefer Democrats to tamp down kind of those calls. And I think the rest of progressives are along those lines, even if they're not as far as Tom Steyer is on saying, you know, let's do impeachment now. So the division there is really one of tactics. And do you want to be a moderate in your approach to campaigning, to try to appeal to people who, you know, either supported Trump or who are turned off by partisan politics? Or do you go for the gut or go for the throat, rather?
Mm. Right. And so that would play well at that with that audience. But once you're out of the conference and trying to run for office and trying to campaign in suburban, more conservative districts, that might be more difficult.
That's exactly right. And this is really the crux of, I think, the debate within the Democratic Party right now, not only about 2018, but especially about 2020. And that is this divide over, do you shape your message for kind of the lower educated, rural white voters who you lost in 2016, and I'm thinking about especially the upper Midwest states that Trump sweeped, you know, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan. Do you do that and try to get back those voters? Or if you're the Democratic Party and you see what's happened in, say, California, which is now completely Democratic, it's completely Democratic because of changing demographics that are slowly shifting across the rest of the country. So there's an argument to be made that forget Iowa, for example, and instead focus on Georgia, a state where in 2016, you know, Trump won Georgia, but by fewer points than even Iowa, a traditional swing state.
Right. So it's the economy versus identity politics. Is that what it's shaping up to be, or is that too simple?
No, I think that's I think that you just said it a lot better than I did. And what I took 2 minutes and you took 2 seconds. That's a point in your corner.
Okay, but why can't it be all of that? Because everybody's concerned about the economy.
Well, you'll hear some people say that it doesn't have to be an either or, but the message might not work in both places. You know, a moderate Democrat might say we shouldn't talk so much about LGBTQ rights or the most progressive economic policies we can think of, because while they'll play well in Atlanta, they won't play well in Hibbing, Minnesota.
And so what are the main issues that progressives are concerned about and want to hit during this campaign season?
The economy is front and center for them. They care about the economy and jobs. They care about it in a very progressive way. So they talk about health care for all. They talk about growing wages. And then more so than you would see at a gathering of more moderate Democrats, you see a lot of panels and discussions focused on LGBTQ rights. You hear people talking about civil rights a lot more. Cory Booker today was talking about how the senator from New Jersey who might run for president was talking about the economy as a, you know, and the job situation as a civil rights matter. So they're talking about a lot of the same issues that Democrats everywhere are talking about, but in more progressive strains.
Well, not to be too cynical about it, but why do they have to be concerned with the progressive arm of the party? They're not going to go anywhere but the Democrats, right? Are they just concerned that they'll sit out these elections if they don't see someone who reflects their views?
Yeah, they're concerned they'll sit it out. So if you're of the belief that demographics will help Democrats, which they should, but if that's going to happen, you need to get those people to register to vote. You know, there are lots of areas and cities where Democrats, if they could bring up non-white voter registration statistics, they would be winning. So they view this as a problem of motivating the base and say the emphasis really needs to be on motivating the base. And the response they would make is that Joe Blow, 55-year-old white guy in Ohio who's a Democrat, has a higher propensity of voting than an 18-year-old black woman in Atlanta. And so they should focus their resources on that woman.
And how much of this is geared towards the upcoming November midterms versus 2020?
One cohesive thing among Democrats is the ability right now to at least say they're all focused on 2018 so that it doesn't make for an earlier fracture, you know, among the lines of these candidates earlier than the November election. But they're all laying plans for 2020.
So they're all trying to sort of set out their markers for where the party should go in terms of who the party's going to nominate to take on Donald Trump.
That's exactly right. And the progressive base, at least in a primary, is very important.
Anyone not attending who is considered a Democratic star, is Joe Biden going to attend, for example?
Joe Biden will not be here, but the more surprising absence, I suppose, is Bernie Sanders, although an enterprising bar across the street from the convention center has an advertisement up saying something like, get a beer with Bernie, perhaps noting his absence. Yeah.
David Siders, national political correspondent for Politico. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why CBS chief Les Moonves keeps his job despite sexual misconduct allegations brought by half a dozen women. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, last Friday, the New Yorker report on Les Moonves came out. It detailed sexual misconduct allegations by six women against CBS chief Les Moonves. Well, he spoke yesterday during a conference call with CBS investors.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for joining us today.
He did not address the allegations.
We're as confident as ever that the strategy we have in place is setting us up for continued long-term success.
But he remains in charge. So, a week later, what has changed for CBS? Joining us now is Kim Masters, editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. Hi there.
Hello.
Well, a lot of people thought his head might roll after this story came out, and yet he remains atop CBS. Are you surprised?
Somewhat. I mean, I would have expected maybe that he would take a leave, but he did not. He is in the middle of this battle with Shari Redstone, who wanted to merge CBS with her other company, Viacom. They are suing each other, and I think it's a fight to the death. And Les has of the 11 board members that are solidly behind him. Shari Redstone has three, including herself, so that that board tilts towards Leslie Moonves, and Leslie Moonves is seen as so critical to the success of CBS that I'm not actually surprised that the board is doing everything it can to defend him.
And yet it also came out that the board knew months ago that there were allegations that the LAPD was investigating.
There were allegations of something that happened allegedly in the 1980s. An 81-year-old woman went to the police. They did not pursue because the statute of limitations has expired. I reported earlier this week that the board, Shari Redstone and another board member in her faction had written to the board in June and said, we have sources telling us of misconduct specifically involving Leslie Moonves and it should be investigated. It doesn't seem that there was a response to that. But now that this Roman Farrow article ran, they have, CBS has hired two law firms, two prominent women, two very white shoe Wall Street law firms. And those, they are supposed to conduct an investigation. And as I said, some people would have expected Les Moonves to take a leave, but he is going to brazen it out for as long as he can, and we'll see how long that is.
Are shareholders saying that's okay?
You know, if I'm a CBS shareholder, I have to be very nervous because there's nothing. Part of the reason I think people, there are a couple of reasons why certain people have been sticking by Les's side through all of this. And one of them is that he's seen as so critical. He is like the last showman entertainment exec atop one of these companies with a creative background. CBS, in a really challenging time, has done really well, just announced strong second quarter results yesterday. So that is one of the reasons they're backing him. And the other, they have a little bit of a, maybe a little space, because the allegations, with one exception in the Roman Farrow piece, are more than 20 years old. And there is an argument that was made by Terry Press, who works for Les as head of CBS Film. Are we looking at conduct more than 20 years ago through a 2018 lens? And you can argue that a couple of ways. I mean, I don't think it was legal to harass women even 20 years ago or 20 or more. But on the other hand, Hollywood, the culture of Hollywood, was not exactly abiding by the rules at all at that point. So this is the question that some of the people who want to be supportive of Moonves and even some people who don't have a ferret in the fight are making.
Well, so are we seeing a change then, or a limiting of the Me Too movement? I mean, I'm thinking of Al Franken, for example. Those charges were many, many years old, and yet he was gone in an instant.
Well, a lot of people feel that that should not happen. You know, when people talk to me about how they feel about the Me Too movement, the most common complaint I hear is that Al Franken was pushed out, and a lot of people feel passionately that he should not have been. Other people feel passionately that he should have been. But I think we are, you know, in terms of the stories that have come out, you know, Harvey Weinstein, obviously a completely clean hit. He had a long history and was basically a kind of a friendless person. And other people, you know, there were patterns of conduct that were more recent. My stories with John Lasseter or the head of Amazon Studios, Roy Price. What we are getting to this point where it's not necessarily a total slam dunk to all people. You know, there's not unanimity of opinion on this.
So meanwhile, as you say, there is this battle between him, between CBS and Viacom, and that proceeds apace. How does this change that battle?
Well, clearly, I mean, you can look at Shari Redstone one way or the other. You could say she was genuinely outraged to find out that there were allegations of misconduct, or you can say, wow, this is helpful for her. Certainly at CBS, there's suspicion that she had, you know, less investigated. There's all sorts of rumblings that they leaked things to Ronan Farrow. Of course, Ronan Farrow started reporting a story long before that fight between Redstone and Moonves started. Nonetheless, it's, you know, you can put things into the water and maybe some of it floats toward a reporter who's doing a story, then the reporter doesn't even know who put it in the water in the first place. So who knows? But the state of play now is, with, I'd have to say, advantage Shari Redstone. But again, she has a fiduciary obligation to CBS shareholders. And what has been a problem for her so far is that getting rid of Leslie Moonves and replacing him with who knows who. And it's a big regime over there that is very loyal to Les. And therefore, it's not going to be just Les Moonves leaves. There will be, I mean, a lot could flow from this. She could then merge Viacom and CBS, and the whole thing could be sold. CBS could potentially just become like Fox is now becoming, sort of an afterthought in, and not the legacy company that it has been for a long time. So there's a lot of nervousness around the fact that Shari looks to have the advantage, but I'd say that's the state of play right now.
So maybe it is actually in her best interest to keep Les Moonves around.
Well, in a purely financial sense, I would say absolutely, and so does Wall Street. There's one or two who disagree, but I'd say the great number of people who are Wall Street analysts want Leslie Moonves, his skill there, to keep being a thing. And at the upfronts in May, you know, he got a standing ovation from advertisers just for walking on stage. And then he was, at that point, he was under siege from Shari Redstone, but this Me Too stuff hadn't happened yet. So he's got a lot of people who are trying to, you know, figure a way not to say he should be fired. And then there are people who are just saying this is unacceptable. I mean, Stephen Colbert said, you know, the law, the rules have to apply to everybody. I'm surprised he came out quite as strongly as he did, because as he said, Les Moonves gave him all of this opportunity and he said he is my guy. But he ultimately came around to the conclusion that this is unacceptable conduct.
Kim Masters, editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. Thanks, Kim.
Thank you.
Coming up, another Winnie the Pooh movie from Disney is out this week.
It's kind of gross to see the corporatization of this rather innocent character occur.
We'll have your movie reviews next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Oh, bother.
What a week. But it's Friday, so it's time for movie reviews. Amy Nicholson is film critic for The Guardian and host of the podcast Unspooled. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
And Whitney Seibold is here. He contributes to IGN and co-hosts the podcasts Critically Acclaimed and Canceled Too Soon. Hi, Whitney.
Good to be here.
First up, a film adaptation of a popular YA book. It's called The Darkest Minds, and it stars Mandy Moore.
Soon, there wouldn't be any kids anywhere. The government wasn't afraid of what happened to the ones that didn't make it. They were afraid of us. Because the ones that survived changed.
Okay, what's happening? It seems Hunger Games-ish.
It's more X-Men-ish. It's the future. A virus has wiped out 90% of the population under 17, and those that remain have been granted superpowers. And there are various levels of superpowers amongst the youth. Some can float things with their minds, and the lead character, played by Amandla Stenberg, she plays a character named Ruby. She can read your thoughts and influence your actions. She's considered the most dangerous, and she has to go on the lam. Everything you'll see in this movie is pretty derivative of things you've seen in YA fiction before. The one special chosen one who is going to use force to take down an evil system run by corrupt adults. The handsome, impossibly handsome young stud who has to lust desperately after the lead character.
So this does sound like The Hunger Games.
It's a lot like The Hunger Games. It's a lot like Divergent. It's not quite as militant as Divergent, thankfully, but it's just as uninspired. YA adaptations seem to be on the outs. They seem to be on sort of a waning phase right now, and it's kind of curious to see something come up again, especially one that feels so derivative of stuff like the X-Men and stuff like the Hunger Games. In fact, so much time has passed since this boom began with Harry Potter back in 2001 that the characters in The Darkest Minds compare themselves to Harry Potter characters. They recognize their scenario, say, well, I'm a lot like Harry Potter, so you must be Hermione in this situation. Or maybe you're Ginny Weasley.
Well, that's unfortunate because then you think, well, those were good movies.
Those were good movies, and they were sort of inspired, and they kicked all of this off, and it seems like the film is now openly acknowledging their own banality. It's pretty efficiently made. I mean, the action is exciting enough, and the performances are really great, especially Amandla Stenberg. She was in a film called Everything, Everything.
And The Hunger Games, right?
And she was also in The Hunger Games. And she is unbelievably charming, and she's going to be a big star, but she's not enough to really carry any of this material to any sort of novel place. It is all completely uninteresting. There, of course, is a setup for a sequel, and my guess is we're not going to see that sequel.
Ouch. Okay. Next up, another YA adaptation. This is called The Miseducation of Cameron Post, and it stars Chloe Grace Moretz as a teen who is sent to gay conversion therapy in the 90s.
You don't really seem like the kind of person that'd be here.
We didn't have a choice, did you?
You better be ready for the dark days.
I mean, couldn't we just walk off?
And go where? What's worse, karaoke night or living on the streets?
Where does my heart be?
tough call.
You'd rather hit the room.
All right, Amy, what did you think of this one?
Yeah, well, the adaptation of this by Desiree Akhavan did fantastic at this year's Sundance. It won the jury's grand prize for dramatic film, which is a little surprising. It's a small film. It's a very well-intentioned film. It's a terrific showcase for Chloe Grace Moretz. This movie is really the Chloe Grace Moretz show because her character in here is in love with her best friend from high school. They've kind of come up with a system where they go on double dates with guys and then sneak off and they have to get to have their own private date, but they're caught during prom. She's sent to this camp where she tentatively befriends one of the voices you heard in there, Sasha Lane, who was in American Honey, also Forrest Goodluck, who was Leonardo DiCaprio's kid in The Revenant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of a shifting allegiances high school movie. You know, it feels very contained by nature because they're adrift in this gay conversion camp with these counselors who don't always have their best intentions in mind, or at least aren't really listening to what they're saying at all. And they start to wonder who's a narc, who's not a narc. And you can just kind of see little jealousies creep in. It's a film with a lot of great moments that I didn't find particularly gripping. It's not really going anywhere surprising.
Yeah.
But acting wise, I was absolutely interested.
And you're in the 90s for what reason?
Maybe so they can shoplift really cool albums.
And have some grunge fashion.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's another film in the same vein coming out later this year. And so I think we're in this moment of really looking at how are we shaping our kids' minds and their attitudes towards, you know, their own feelings about who they want to love. And so these films kind of both do the same thing where they break apart into how the different kids are going to handle it, who's really working hard to try to get over it, who has a complete cynical flip attitude towards it, that's Sasha Lane. And then also just what is it like to be so trapped in a moment where you feel like an adult but don't have any rights.
So both of these movies are similar in that sense. That they're both about the evil,
angst, yeah.
The uncaring evil adults and the rebellious teens.
Yeah, what's wrong with adults, man?
Exactly. One day, these kids will know what it's like to be an adult.
Parents
All right.
just don't understand.
I think we should reverse it. Want to have a movie based on rebellious adults against the straight-laced teens.
Well, that's kind of what Bad Moms was about, I think.
Oh, right.
And also Family Ties.
Oh, well,
that's
yeah.
right. Exactly. Let's bring that back. All right. Next up, another trip to the 100 Acre Wood, Disney's Christopher Robin.
I promised my wife and daughter I'd take them away this weekend.
All hands on deck.
You won't be coming to the cottage.
Well, it can't be helped.
Your life is happening now, right in front of you.
What to do, what to do, what to do.
What to do indeed.
Pooh?
Christopher Robin.
No.
The tree I remember was in the countryside, not here in London. There's no opening.
I suppose it's where it needs to be.
Well, it's a silly explanation.
Why, thank you.
All right, Whitney, you saw this one. It stars Ewan McGregor as Christopher Robin as a grown-up.
This film cribs very heavily from the Steven Spielberg film Hook, which is the same story, just with Peter Pan. Christopher Robin has grown into a very serious businessman, is teaching his young daughter to be very serious and study a lot. And into his crisis of adulthood comes his childhood best friend, Winnie the Pooh. Winnie the Pooh is not a figment of his imagination, but an actual living, talking stuffed animal that other people can see and interact with.
So he's not crazy.
He's not crazy, and it also raises some pretty disturbing questions as to what those stuffed animals were doing in the woods for the last 30 years. And there is a sequence where Pooh is wandering around a really marshy, hazy, gray 100-acre wood with no other animals around, just sort of talking about honey. And you wonder if that was his weird existentialist
nightmare.
Well,
he is nightmare. A bear of very little brain.
Little brain and big heart, yes, as they repeat endlessly throughout this unbelievably treacly movie. The tropes in this of the workaholic dad having to reconnect with his childhood are so worn to tatters. I'm guessing it's guilty executives trying to pay penance for spending time away from their own families. It's just a pity that now we have to have this through this really not very well-intentioned Winnie the Pooh reboot.
Yeah.
There was a line in Saving Mr. Banks, the Disney film about P.L. Travers, the author of Mary Poppins. She was concerned that Disney was going to take her product and turn it into something treacly and dumb and commercial, which indeed they did. And there's a line in that where she says, poor A.A. Milne. They took Winnie the Pooh and turned it into something really terrible. Well, this is exactly what she was referring to. They took something very well-intentioned, something very innocent, something almost zen, And over the years, Winnie the Pooh has become more and more increasingly commercialized to the point where now it's part of that big Disney remake machine. And it's kind of gross to see the corporatization of this rather innocent character occur.
Well, that's why I'm glad that here in LA we have this theater company called Zombie Joe's who did a production called Dirty Pooh. And I have to say that their piglet is incredible. It's a good correction.
Yeah. Okay.
Is this safe for all audiences?
Oh, I wouldn't
Maybe
put it.
Not.
Well, it'll give a child a lot to talk about.
Last up, we have a buddy comedy, The Spy Who Dumped Me, and this stars Mila Kunis and Kate McKinnon.
It's a flash drive.
You have to swallow it before they come back.
There is no turning back for us.
We're semi-professionals at this point.
Professional. We are professional.
It's a new dawn. It's a new day. It's a new life. It's a new life for me.
Oh, my God, I killed someone!
Okay, so these two are hapless spies. Is that the idea?
They are hapless LA girls. And Mila Kunis has no idea that her boyfriend, who just dumped her over text sort of rudely, is a spy. He's played by Justin Theroux, and he's racing around chasing after things. In the opening sequence, you're basically in a James Bond movie that is his life while cutting to her movie, which is a girl comedy about her and her best friend having an uncomfortable birthday party and hating their coworkers. I have to say right up at the top, this movie is made for me. It feels very made for me. It opens.
Is this your relationship?
Well, you know, every year, my best friend Eva and I go on a trip to a place where we're utterly out of our depth. We go to Kiev. We go to Havana. And so they're living our life. And it opens with my karaoke song, Wind of Change. So thank you, Susanna Fogel, the director, for making a movie that felt like I needed to stop the film and text my best friend and have her come and meet me. Susanna Fogel has been doing these really interesting girl comedy. She wrote the film Life Partners with Jillian Jacobs a couple years ago, if anybody saw that. And what really worked for me here is that this isn't one of those comedies where the girls are running around and breaking a heel and the laughter is, ha ha, girl bad at her job and falls down. They're making fun of this trope of those kind of female spy movies, the high-toned ones, within the film. There's a character played by this Ukrainian actress, Ivana Sadko, and she is just absolutely trashing Red Sparrow, Atomic Blonde. She's this Eastern European gymnast who kills people with her thighs. And meanwhile, Kate McKinnon and Mila Kunis are over here just being sloppy, goofy, normal Americans. And their dynamic is super fun. You can just tell that they're having the best time together.
There's a really terrific scene where the Ukrainian assassin is perched in her gun tower. And she's told to assassinate two dumb American women. And there are so many targets to choose from where she is, that she doesn't know who she's supposed to be shooting.
I'm sorry, world. I've tried to be smart when I travel, but it's hard.
Well, we love Kate McKinnon.
Kate McKinnon is kind of the star of this one. Mila Kunis has the chore of shouldering a lot of the plot and a lot of the emotional journey, whereas Kate McKinnon is excited to be there in every single scene. She sees this as nothing but an adventure and as a way to sort of make their friendship a lot deeper. And she takes every opportunity she can to compliment her best friend, to talk about how this is an opportunity for women to take charge. And then later in the film, when she meets the head of MI6, played by Gillian Anderson, she just loses her mind over just how much she admires this woman. She even says something along the lines of, "I admire you so much that it's circled back around to now I'm objectifying you."
So you think that maybe she ad-libbed that, or is the writing...
It feels like she ad-libbed it. And that might be the film's one weakness. Whenever you make an action comedy, it's best to make the action really tight and pace it. And modern comedy trends dictate that the actors and the comedians be allowed to sort of riff and talk and let the material breathe a little bit. And the two tones don't quite match.
Yeah,
there's going to be moments where it feels like it drags or a scene doesn't belong. And it feels kind of sloppy at the end.
But yeah, every action comedy has the exact same third act problem when suddenly they have to actually do something.
Yeah, do just the action.
Yeah, and that's always a bummer. But they carry it through okay here. The first two-thirds of this movie, though, I was absolutely dying. Mm. I felt like they had looked into my cell phone and taken jokes I had made. So I just think this is absolutely delightful. I hope people give it a chance this weekend.
Okay, so we have a winner, finally. Whitney Seibold contributes to IGN and co-hosts the podcast Critically Acclaimed and Canceled Too Soon. And Amy Nicholson is film critic for The Guardian and host of the podcast Unspooled. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, how Paul Manafort dressed the part he is now trying to distance himself from in court. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Paul Manafort's trial is in day four in Virginia. He's facing bank and tax fraud charges. And because of the nature of those charges, the proceedings are full of accounting talk, documents, bank records. It does get juicy, however. Juicy in the form of his luxury wardrobe, including the now infamous $15,000 ostrich jacket and another coat made of snakeskin. Late Night, of course, has noticed.
First of all, if you're trying not to seem evil, maybe don't dress up as a snake. Also, what's the point of wearing ostrich if you're going to take off all the feathers? That just seems like a waste.
Okay, Trevor Noah there. Yeah, the jokes really do seem to write themselves. But for some real insight and deep fashion analysis, we're turning to none other than Robin Givhan, fashion critic for The Washington Post. Hi there.
Hi.
Well, let's begin with that ostrich jacket. And you say that it is not only an atrocity, it is really symbolic for something that Paul Manafort is trying to convey. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the jacket is, when you look at it, it's not this display of any kind of particular craftsmanship or creativity. It's a very basic jacket. Its real purpose is to be a conveyance of ostrich leather, which is exotic and expensive. So it really is just a statement of being able to afford something that the vast majority of the population cannot. It's a way of setting yourself apart. It's a way of sort of bragging. You know, it's just a way of sort of saying, hey, I'm winning.
Mm-hmm. And he spent, what, like nearly $1 million in 5 years on suits, on various fashion items?
He did. And certainly there are people who would say, okay, you know, if you are really into the deep end of luxury fashion, you could conceivably do that with not a lot of effort. But what's interesting about his choices is that this was not someone who was out there buying examples of really rarefied fashion, you know, clothing that perhaps was handmade or has some particularly interesting detail. In many ways, when you look at the many, 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 many suits in his wardrobe, you know, they're not particularly distinguishable from something that you might see off the rack. What is notable is simply they were very expensive.
And a lot of them came from this place here in Beverly Hills called the House of Bijan. And
yes, and I chuckle.
Yeah, just describe that, because for people who aren't particularly aware, this is quite an institution.
I would say its heyday was really in the conspicuous consumption of the 1980s. It wasn't the highest quality store or the most creative. It was really just about being able to brag about how much you were spending on your clothes. I joked that not so long ago, when another designer was introducing a collection of pretty rarefied menswear, someone sort of teasingly said, oh, are you going to be the next Bijan? And I said, that person has not been seen or heard from since.
Oh, dear. Yeah, but so Paul Manafort would wear these suits. And, you know, looking at the jackets, some of them look exactly out of some, I don't know, James Cagney movie in a sense, a double-breasted pinstriped suit. It's almost like he was dressing the part of a mobster.
You know, I will stipulate that rare is the suit that's going to look great on a hanger that's been tossed over a closet door and photographed in bad lighting. So certainly the prosecution did not do the suits even close to what might be called justice. But, you know, you're right. I mean, the thing that is really striking about so much of this wardrobe is that it feels and looks so connected to another time. Mm-hmm. It looks very 1980s, which was a period of ostentation mm-hmm. in dress. And the point of dress was not about sophistication and finesse and nuance. It was about big, sweeping gestures of a kind of capitalist gluttony.
Yeah, and also when he came into his career with Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it happens sometimes with people that that point at which they feel that they are at their best, that's the point at which their sense of themselves freezes in that moment. And even though these clothes were, you know, purchased in the 21st century, they still reflect a person who seems to be dressing for a point that was a heyday some 40 years ago.
So obviously the prosecution wants to make a point with the jurors. And it's not that he spent a ton of money on clothes, because he could have spent a ton of money on Levi's, I guess, and it wouldn't have the same effect. But the fact that he spent a ton of money on House of Bijan, that says something different.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that the judge said was that he didn't want there to be this long laundry list of detailing fancy suits, because that would influence the jury. And then he went on to say that, you know, whether it was Men's Warehouse or House of Bijan, you know, was irrelevant. And I absolutely agree that it would, in fact, sway the jury to some degree to hear about the expensive nature of these clothes. But I would also argue that part of the reason why he, in fact, bought these clothes was because of their expense and what he wanted to convey with that. So you could absolutely argue that the labels in those clothes would have an impact, and possibly a negative impact, on the jury. I don't think you could simultaneously argue that it's irrelevant. I think it's quite irrelevant, because it goes directly to this public persona that he was constructing with his clothes.
Finally, can we talk about that snakeskin jacket? Where would
python?
One, yeah, where would one wear such a thing?
That is a very good question, and I would love to go through the photo archives and see if I could come up with an image of Mr. Manafort in that jacket at some event. But I think it was clearly meant to be a jacket that he wore in his leisure time. And what his leisure time consisted of, where a python jacket would be appropriate, I do not know.
Is a python jacket ever appropriate from a fashion standpoint?
I think many years of covering the fashion industry has taught me never to say never, because some designer can come along and suddenly make python the most desirable thing around. So it's certainly possible. I would say it's not probable.
Robin Givhan is fashion critic for The Washington Post. Thanks, Robin.
Thank you.
And wearing his one-of-a-kind caterpillar jacket.
My ostrich KCRW t-shirt.
Exactly.
Well, we asked earlier, you talked earlier about, you know, the whole kind of rift within the Democratic Party between those who want to push it more in a progressive, left-leaning direction and those who want to stay more centrist. So I asked listeners about that, whether they would like to see their Democratic Party, those who are Democrats out there, which way they'd like to go. Citizen X says stay in the center, because it all takes all opinions to come to a compromise. Far right and far left are born out of fear. Whereas Ted Mills says left, left, left. Guess what happens when you try to appeal to a mythical center? Trump happens. Big money, big banks, big business are not our friends and shouldn't be our donors.
All right. I'm sure there are no shortage of opinions out there on that
no.
topic. Okay. Thank you, Christian Bordahl. That's it for Press Play. Our show is directed by Sarah Sweeney, produced by the resident Norwegian himself, Amy Ta, Michelle Aloy, Anna Scott, and Yael Evan Orr. Quinn O'Toole is our managing producer. Mario Saavedra, our technical director, with engineering help today from Phil Richards. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll be out next week. Barbara Bogue fills in. And have a great weekend.